ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome back to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last. It's my pleasure to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us up and down that highway, up and down the Smoky Mountains, sharing wrestling history and beyond with us each and every week. Without any further ado, the man of the hour, the host of the Studcast, the noted archaeologist, Ron Fuller. Ron, how are you?
I'm doing great, my man. Just fantastic. Really a beautiful day in the Smokies here, and I'm really looking forward to it. Got old Lightning saddled up, and we got a pretty good ride in store for today. We're going to do a lot of stuff, and as you mentioned, I'm starting to get my thinking straight on becoming an archaeologist, man. So don't think I'm going to make a profession out of it, but we are going to start discussing that a little bit in some of these episodes and a little bit today.
Well, I could dig that, and I'm sure the rest of the listeners hated that pun as much as I did as soon as it left my mouth. But Ron, before we get to the rest of the show, quick mention, because as this show comes out, we have already released the latest Super Studcast, part 2 of Super Studcast 19 with Dirty Dutch Mantel. Check this out today at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. For only $2.99, you get in the door. This is over 90 minutes here in part 2 with Dirty Dutch Mantel. And there's lots of really, really funny stories. Great stuff about Brad Armstrong. There's a really funny Robert Fuller story. And it's not only a funny story, but you get to hear Dutch tell it, and then you get to hear Ron tell what he heard about the story, and so much more. This is a really fun Super Studcast. Check it out today, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. We'll have more information later in the show. But Ron, in regards to this week's show, where are we going?
Well, we're going to discuss my conversation with Jerry Jarrett, where I informed him about my summer plans for 1975. We're going to talk about the loss of the Southern Championship. We're going to discuss my record while holding that championship. We're going to set up plans for the archaeological dig and where it's going to be. Discuss my plan to end the $100,000 lawsuit that I've finally got myself a little bit of a plan. And we're going to look at the Knoxville card and the TV for June 13th, 1975. And we're going to start thinking about trying my first spot show since going on to WBIR-TV five weeks earlier. So we've got a pretty exciting episode. We're going to cover a lot of ground today. And so if you don't mind, I'm going to jump right in, Brian. We'll start rolling here. We talked briefly last episode about my plans to support my wife in an attempt to save my marriage in the summer of 1975. I decided that I'd like to join her in an archaeological dig for American Indian artifacts. My wife was going to spend about 5 days a week with my two sons in a motel in South Central Tennessee, just off Interstate 24 near the small town of Manchester, Tennessee, where they're about to build this giant lake. She needed a few more credits to graduate from the University of Tennessee. And in the last episode, I introduced her professor, Dr. William Bass, and he was responsible for her opportunity to get those extra credits for graduation by including her in an upcoming archaeological dig. Now, he and I became good friends, and I felt comfortable enough to discuss with him what's happening in my marriage. I got to be that close of friends with him. He sympathized with me, and he put me on the roster of students that would be working on the dig for the summer. So it basically allowed me to be with my family the entire week, every week during the summer on this dig, even though I wasn't even enrolled as a student at the University of Tennessee. I doubt that many people that's not students ever worked on one of these archaeological digs, but William Bass put me on this one, and I was mighty glad that he did. Since we're on the subject of the archaeological dig, let's spend a few minutes describing where and what this dig is all about. It's in South Central Tennessee, close, like I said, to the city of Manchester, and they're building a huge dam there that's going to create a monster lake 17 miles long called Lake Normandy. It was common knowledge that American Indians had lived in this beautiful part of the country. Pretty much everybody knew that. When the dam was finished and the Duck River that flowed into that dam, and it's going to back up water, obviously, it's going to cover the Indio burial grounds and the reservation forever. So this was to be a last chance opportunity to gather artifacts from this hallowed ground. Whoever was in control of the building of the lake had established where they wanted to dig and chosen the University of Tennessee to provide the students for the dig. We were to be there in the last week of June 1975 to prepare to start the dig and finish in early September. And I'll give a few details about this dig every week as the program goes along. But right now, I think we're going to jump back into wrestling.
Well, but hold on, Ron. How many days a week are you there for the dig?
5 days a week.
Okay, so you're 5 days there and then 2 days back in Knoxville?
2 days back in Knoxville, but that's going to change pretty quickly here. By the time we get started on the dig, I'm going to have to start running more towns, and we'll be talking about that in the next program. But we'll be starting to run some spot shows, and I'm going to be leaving there on Thursdays. We'll drive two cars, my wife and I, from Knoxville down to Chattanooga, and we take Interstate 24 up toward Nashville. About halfway to Nashville is Manchester. And I'm going to be leaving on Thursdays, going back to Knoxville and working spot shows on Thursday night and starting on Saturday nights now. And every Friday I'll be in Knoxville. She'll come home on Fridays. So I'm basically working from Monday to Wednesday or to Thursday mornings. And then I go home. I don't work there actually on Thursdays. So I'm doing 4 days a week or close to 4 days a week there on the dig. And then I'm back home and doing what I should be doing all the time, basically, as I'm running my company. So, in fact, we had a pretty big laugh the last episode about the substance of this call that I'm about to make to Jerry Jarrett in this time frame to inform him about what my summer plans are for wrestling. And on June 3rd, 1975, I made that call. And as you surmised last episode, Jarrett was a little bit dumbfounded by my explanation for not being able to continue in Memphis beyond June 23rd, 1975. He could not believe that I would take off an entire summer to do something like this. You know, ignoring your work as a wrestler to support your wife and her endeavors was just not done during that day and time. We discussed, he and I, why I thought I needed to do it. And I think he became a little more sympathetic, but not really. He didn't really get the gist of how important it was. But we also talked about the problems I was having with my $100,000 lawsuit and what had happened to cause that. He didn't even know anything about that. So we had a discussion about several different things on June 3rd, 1975. And one was to tell him that I would no longer be working for him past June 23rd of 1975.
That's Jerry Jarrett's reaction. How did your father react to the news that you were going to be leaving your territory several days a week to go on an archaeological dig and obviously canceling your future commitments with Memphis?
Well, you know, I don't believe Brian, I even told him, because I knew what his reaction would be. he would have probably had a few choice words for me, you know, like what the hell are you doing? You know? So, So I think I avoided that. I don't believe he knew what was going on. Now, he might have known before I finished the dig, because I'm sure I talked to him at some point during that summer. But he lived on one side of the state. I lived on the other. And there was a lot of times that we didn't communicate very much. So I felt good about having given him, Jarrett, talking about Jarrett, the traditional 2 weeks notice. He thanked me for that. A record 6 months of box office in Memphis. He really was on top of it from January into June of 1975. During that time period, he also thanked me for three, as he put it, tremendous world title matches with Jack Briscoe. He complimented me on what was happening in Knoxville, since he'd been there on many of those cards and had seen the growth in business and had heard about the new TV station and the great TV program I now had put together. He told me that since my brother was working for him at that point, he would make him available to me on Fridays whenever I liked, even though I wasn't going to be working for him and coming back to Memphis for a while. Then he asked me, like most promoters do, for a small favor, and he asked if I could work Louisville, Kentucky for him and Chattanooga, Tennessee for Nick Gulas one more time to get the Mongolian Stomper a win over me there for the Southern title. We agreed upon the date for those appearances, and I would see him only three more times before June 23rd, 1975. That's the last Monday that I would be working in Memphis. After that date, I would not see him again until September 9th, 1975, after the archaeological dig was completed. When I returned in September, I would work for him eight more times only in the year of 1975.
Did you have any issues at all with putting over the Mongolian Stomper on your way out?
None whatsoever. I mean, you know, I haven't been in the wrestling family all my life. That's part of the business. You put guys over and they put you over. It's business. And I felt bad to leave him with a fairly short notice, but I did give him the 2 week notice that's pretty much, considered mandatory in the wrestling profession back at those time frames. And it was a nice parting. We had a nice parting here, and I am going to be back there for a few more shows. So let's talk briefly about my run in 1975 as heavyweight champion and also my run in Florida as Southern heavyweight champion. I'd won the Florida version of the Southern heavyweight title from Paul Jones in 1973. I held it for 76 days, successfully defended it 45 times in 76 days, and I eventually lost it to the great Johnny Valentine. It's very strange, but the NWA allowed Southern heavyweight champions to be in several different regions. So Florida had their own Southern champion. Tennessee had their own Southern champion. I won that Florida title in 73. And then I come in at the end of 74 on the December 29th in Memphis. And I win the Tennessee Southern heavyweight championship. So when I win the championship 1229 in Memphis, I defeat Jackie Fargo. It's a tournament in the finals of that tournament. I held that belt this time, the Southern title, for a record 162 straight days, defended it 26 times. It was a special belt to me because it had been won by my grandfather, Roy's brother, Herb Welch. Herb's name was engraved on it as one of the title holders, and I felt honored to put that belt on every time I went to the ring. I was amazed when I recently looked back at the fantastic names I had successfully defended the Southern title, that particular Southern title, against. And this is a pretty phenomenal group of names here. I wrestled Bill Watts for it, Jerry Lawler for it, Dick the Bruiser, Lou Thesz, Danny Hodge, Dale Lewis, Jackie Fargo, George Barnes from Australia, Ron Wright, Norvell Austin, Tommy Gilbert, and Tojo Yamamoto, just a few of them. So my reign came to an end 6 days after my conversation with Jarrett, when the Mongolian Stomper beat me on Monday night, June the 9th, 1975, in Memphis, the same city that I had won it in. So it didn't take long after I had this conversation that Jerry gets to making some movement here, as far as I'm concerned, and he wants to get that belt off of me right away.
What do you remember about that match in Memphis, the one where you lost the title to the Stomper, and also Were there any other matches that you worked as you were working out your notice? Any other matches of note, I should say?
No. Actually, I only have five more matches after I give Jarrett this notice, and every one of them was with the Stomper. And let's start with that June 9th match, the one in which I lost. I'm working with the Mongolian Stomper, and working with him was a nightmare for a whole lot of wrestlers. I mean, his size, and maybe even more so his look than his size, was enough to make fans panic, run, sometimes hurt themselves, trying to get away from him if he just looked into the crowd. And if he made a movement toward the crowd, oh, they would have riots and chairs would go flying and everybody would run from him. And I have a suspicion that a whole lot of wrestlers panicked when they saw they were booked against him as well. So, and I'd luckily already been worked with many, many guys who were larger and even more fearful looking than the Stomper. Working with the Stomper didn't bother me in any way whatsoever. He was certainly not as stiff as Johnny Valentine or Hans Schmidt. He wasn't as fearsome looking as Abdullah the Butcher or Pak Song, and he certainly wasn't as dangerous as Luthez or Danny Hodge. But as I have said before on the Studcast, I would have given almost anything to have the Mongolian Stomper in my territory at that time in 1975.
Beyond seeing him and wanting him to work for you and watching him work, did you actually get to know him a little bit during this period of time? Have you started talking to him and really getting to know Archie Gouldie as a person?
Yes. Yes, and I made a point of it because I really wanted to have him work for me someday, and I wanted to build some type of rapport with him. Every night, especially during these five matches that I have at the end after I've given my notice to Jarrett and Stomper beats me for the title, I'm going to work with him another five times. And I really, really enjoyed getting to know him better. And I had a feeling that someday I would get a call from him. So this match on the 9th of 1975, June 9th, in which Stomper beats me for the championship, I bet I probably worked with Archie for at least 200 times in my career. But I never got over just how good a shape he was always in. He never blew up in any of those 200 matches I ever had. And I probably blew up in 100 of them. You know, I mean, he was really in phenomenal shape. I never blew up, in any of these matches, in any of these five. And this one for the Southern title in Memphis was not the best match I ever had with him, obviously. And that's not uncommon. It was our first match together. The more you work with a guy, the better match you usually have. We did, however, tear the house down every time I ever wrestled him, no matter where it was. I was over very strong by then in Memphis as a babyface, and he was very hot as a heel. His manager, Bearcat Wright, was responsible for his win of the title. I think Jarrett wanted to take care of me because I was so over there, and that therefore made sense for the manager to win all those matches, to be responsible for beating me. Jarrett didn't really want to beat me, but you got to beat somebody to change a championship, and it had to happen. So I put him over, Stomper, in the middle of the ring. And like I said before, doing jobs with top guys was never a problem for me because I came from a wrestling family and that made their living in the sport. And it was just part of business. And I learned early on that business is business and you do what you need to do and you don't quibble about losing. And it didn't make any difference whether for a championship or not. You never complained about losing a match. And if you did, you were jeopardizing your own future. I would not work with Stomper again after these five matches until 1977. It's really amazing here, almost 2 years. And thankfully, when that happens again in 1977, he's going to be part of my Southeastern territory. He's going to be with me and working for me.
Obviously, you gave notice with a very interesting reason to Jerry Jarrett. Did you think the door was open for you to return after the archaeological dig? Or were you even looking to return?
Well, yes, I kind of hoped that I would be able to return. I don't like to burn any bridges. That's not a good thing for any wrestler to do. You never know where you're going to need to go and where you're going to need to work. So I definitely wanted to go back there. I had done very well there. had made some very good money there, and so had Jerry. Jerry, you know, he pretty much said, yeah, thank you for the tremendous business we've done in that seven-month period of time that I was there in Memphis. So, I really believe that you need to do whatever's asked of you in wrestling, unless you own the company. If you own the company, you get to make a lot of the decisions of it. And that's maybe one reason I wanted to be an owner of a company, because I did want to be able to kind of own my own destiny.
Obviously, the pay is determined by the size of the house, but on average, how big of a financial hit is this for you, voluntarily stepping away from Memphis?
It's substantial, you know, and I don't know if you've got your little calculator there, but I was making a guarantee of $1,000 a week, $1,000 a show there. Some shows, big world championship shows, I made twice that. So, you know, just what is $1,000 a week in 75 money compared to what that is worth today?
$1,000 in 1975 is worth approximately $4,700 in 2019.
Not bad money.
No.
No, I mean, that's a pretty darn good payoff. And sometimes it was as much as $9,000 in or close to it when I had those world championship matches against Jack Briscoe that sold out, a couple of them at raised prices. So it was a great place to work. I had done very well there. He had taken care of me great, and I appreciated it very much. And I did want to go back there. I did not want to burn that bridge. And I managed not to, in spite of the fact that I was going to, on an archaeological dig rather than putting on my trunks and going to work every night. But he understood enough that he did not hold it against me. Let's change gears a little bit and update everybody on the $100,000 lawsuit. I said earlier we were going to talk about that today. Last week, I explained that I had hired an attorney, and he and I discussed ways to handle this without having to go to trial. We talked about several options, but the one that really appealed to me was trying to meet with this guy that had been injured to find out how badly he was actually hurt and if there was any chance he might be willing to settle without attorneys. My biggest problem with that was I didn't want people to know I owned Southeastern, and maybe more important, I was still a heel. A heel trying to deal with a real fan on something like this would have no chance, in my opinion, of working out an agreement. You know, a guy doesn't like you to begin with, and he's actually got these injuries, so it's not going to be an easy deal for him to say, yeah, I'll cut you some type of deal here. I'd spent a great deal of time and thought to make fans hate me, and now it was working against me in this case. You know, I had all this heat, and I can't really go to the guy and do anything about it. So I must admit, I started to think about turning babyface just to save myself money on this lawsuit. You know, it's a natural instinct that you would do that. And it had only been 2.5 months since the plaintiff had been injured by this lawsuit. And had really taken its and it had taken its toll on me this 2.5 months. I'm going to continue to kind of like with the archaeological digs to provide updates on pretty much every stud cast until this is remedied. And as a little hint, in the future, pretty quickly, I'm going to turn babyface in Knoxville before I ever meet with this guy. So there is going to be something good come out of this.
And obviously, this is one fan that does know that you're the promoter because he hired a lawyer. The lawyer looked into who owned Southeastern, so they knew who to serve with the papers. So this one fan actually does know that Ron Fuller owns Southeastern.
That's right. You know, and I'm hoping to keep it and confine it to that, just being that one guy. And that's why I want to try to get this settled as quickly as I can before he has a chance to run around and tell everybody he knows who owns the company. And I think I'm pretty much going to get that done, but it's going to take a little while for me yet to arrange to meet with him.
Obviously, you're not running a full schedule of shows yet. You're building into that. But for all the time that you're away on the archaeological dig, who are your trusted guys in Knoxville? Who do you know that if something went down, you can call and you can get an answer or they could take care of something? Who are you relying on?
Mac. The guy that let me borrow the money to buy the company with. He's my referee. He handles my rings and all my spot shows. He gets those rings to those spot shows. He basically follows behind me and makes sure everything is cleaned up and done properly. He's a fantastic guy to work with and just really extremely reliable. In 5 years of hauling a ring and refereeing, he never missed a single night or a single town.
Wow.
That's pretty darned amazing. And if I ever have anything that I really need done, I have him. I also have Les Thatcher as a backup to him. And Les Thatcher is a very close friend of mine at this point. And I have a lot of respect for Les, and I think he did me at the same time, and I could always call him if there was something Mac couldn't do, it would be Les. Sometimes, if it's a television issue, I would call Les. I would not put Mac in charge of something like that. If it's a town problem or a talent problem, I might discuss it with Mac. So I at least had people that could step in and take over. And you got to bear in mind, too, at this point, I'm not running on Mondays through Wednesdays. I don't have towns operating at all. So it's I'm really not focused on my company at this point. I'm more focused on trying to keep my family and my marriage together. And I can't say that that's a mistake to do that for somebody. But I can say in the long run, it's going to fail. It's not going to work for me anyway. But I still learn a little bit about Indian artifacts, okay, and had what an archaeological dig is all about, too. So I get there's a lot of people that probably don't have much knowledge of that stuff. So it just broadens my mind a little bit.
Well, we will broaden the listeners' minds when they return to Knoxville to find out what was happening on TV and in Knoxville on June 13th. But first, a word about Super Studcast number 19, parts 1 and 2 with Dirty Dutch Mantel.
Part 2 of the very popular Super Studcast number 19 with Down and Dirty Dutch Mantel is now available for patrons worldwide at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. This 3-hour-plus fascinating ride with the stud and his good friend for 44 years, Dutch Mantel, is just like being in the backseat of a vehicle traveling to a wrestling event with them somewhere in America. Stories abound from both as they and all who hear it enjoy these deep dives into lifelong friendships. This one covers everything from Bruiser Brody's death on a night when Dutch was there in Puerto Rico to his WWE days managing Jack Swagger. No wonder Super Studcast are the talk of wrestling fans everywhere. If you have not experienced one of the 19 Super Studcasts now available, this one is a great place to start at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for memories and stories that last a lifetime. Only the stud can provide this type of entertainment.
There you hear it, a down and dirty edition of the Super Studcast, part 1, and now available part 2 with Dirty Dutch Mantel. This is a lot of fun and really filled with a lot of very interesting wrestling history that you need to check out today. TNstud.com or Patreon.com/studcast. For only $2.99, you get into the door. Check it out today. We heard from so many listeners who said, we want to hear the story about Ernie Ladd and the Briscoes. It's on this episode. Check it out today. More info later in the show. But Ron, let's return to Knoxville. You have a card coming up June 13th, 1975.
That's it. And I want to put this card together first before I put the TV show together to promote the card. I think that's a little simpler for fans out there to keep up with. So first we're going to talk about what the card is and who won the matches in each of these on this card. And then we'll go back and piece the TV together to show why it was put together that way to promote this card of the 13th. So we're again in the outside amphitheater on June 13, 75. We get the nice weather, and we are going to be outside. Rocky Smith, the former Infernos in the first match against Don Bass. Rocky Smith won that match, and is a very good one for an opening match. He's a great talent, Rocky Smith, and so is Don Bass. I mean, that's a very, very good opening match right there. Ron Wright faced George McCrary in the second match and won easily, which he should have. New star to Southeastern, Tommy Siegler, wins his very first match in Knoxville against the larger brother, Bass brother, Ron Bass. Ron Bass, in my opinion, was a star in the business and became a personal friend after coming to work for me as a single wrestler in Pensacola in the early 1980s. Really loved my dealings with Ron Bass. Tommy Siegler, however, is just as competent and is going to make a very good impression on the Knoxville fans over the next few months in 1975. I brought him in expecting him to be a top babyface, and he has all the ability to do just that. The Mongolian Stomper and his manager, Bearcat Wright, got a win over Don Wright. Ron Wright got involved in the end of this match, and obviously the fans were ready to see the Stomper against tougher competition. And they're going to get their wish in 2 weeks because I'm going to put Ron Wright against the Stomper. And that'll be the last week that the Stomper works for me there. And that should be the way it ends. He ends with really top talent, and it's his first really main eventer that he has wrestled in this six-week period of time that he's been there every show. The main event was a Tennessee Tag Championship on the night of the June 13th. And it was a best two out of three falls with a 60-minute time limit. And the new champions, Jimmy Golden and Ricky Gibson, are wrestling against the Assassin, Jody Hamilton, the one and only, and myself. Two brand new teams versus each other. We put in a lot of time in this match, and in the end, somewhere around the 50-minute mark, with both teams winning the fall, and the third fall becomes a double disqualification when things get out of the referee's control. I mean, if we both get disqualified, there is no actual winner to this match. Notice, too, Brian, that the Basses are not wrestling on this card as a team. And that's because I knew you would pick up on that, and it's because my notice to Jarrett 10 days earlier has already led to the Basses being pulled out of Knoxville. I had expected it after giving Jarrett a notice, but maybe not so soon as what it turned out to be. This show of June 13th is going to be the last one in Knoxville for the Basses. It forced me to quickly establish a team for the new babyface champions to work with. Now, I'd anticipated needing a second heel team earlier, and the Assassin and I had already had two wins in a row against the Wrights, and we are obviously the logical contenders for the new babyface tag team champions. We had recorded my Texas Tornado match with partner Assassin versus Ron and Don Wright the Friday night before on June the 6th, as well as the two out of three fall main event with the Tennessee Tag Champions, with new champions Ricky Gibson and Jimmy Golden against Ron Bass and Don Bass. Recording these two tag matches gave me the opportunity to show teams getting wins and not having to use those teams as often live on TV in the future. But we weren't ready for that yet, and our discussion of the June 7th, 1975 TV next will prove why.
What did you do on TV to build up to this card?
Okay, so, you know, I guys need exposure here yet. It's fine to be filming these matches and showing the very end of the match, but these boys need, especially Golden and Gibson, are new. So is the Assassin new. We've got so much new talent there. I want to give them real impact, and I'm going to do that on this particular TV, and we'll kind of get to it as we come to it here. So let's take a look at the TV show of June 7, 1975, to see how I put it together with the two tag matches that we had recorded to support the June 13th card that we've just discussed. The opening segment of the TV show was with the now established star, the Mongolian Stomper, against George McCrary. Stomper roared to another win with his classic stomp into McCrary's face, and then Bearcat Wright and his wrestler, the Stomper, came to the set and made a two-minute interview after the station's commercial break. Bearcat gave an excellent interview, saying that he had brought his fantastic star to Knoxville for one reason, and that was to put him up against the Hillbilly Wright brothers and finally they were going to get their first shot at one of those Wright brothers, and that's going to be Don Wright. So fans in the studio booed, but I think they all knew Don Wright was in big trouble the following Friday night, especially since that following Friday night was Friday the 13th of June, and he happened to be facing the Mongolian Stomper. He had his work cut out for him, and Stomper is going to finally get his shot a couple of weeks later at the Big Brother. So, you know, we'll get to that probably in next week's episode, the results of these matches that took place on the 20th. But the second segment of this TV show is a big win for Don Wright, which he needed after Bearcat tore him up in the interview and after the first match that Stomper just won on TV. Then both he and his brother Ron took the second interview. Don started off in his normal quiet manner talking about the Stomper, but Big Brother Ron did his thing a little differently when he began. He quickly noted that he was wrestling the same George McCrary that had just been destroyed by the Mongolian Stomper on this very same TV show. And since his opponent the following not Friday was going to be the same George McCrary, he intended to beat McCrary faster than the Stomper had just done it on TV. And then he asked Les, which is very unusual. He asked Les, out of the clear blue, he says, can they time how long it took the Stomper to beat McCrary on this match that was just over, the first match? And so he continued on. The show's director, Bill Kincaid, he instantly called to the back and asked him to time the match. Ron Wright continued his tirade about what his brother was going to do to the Stomper the following Friday, and that he would be watching that shifty manager, Bearcat Wright, next Friday night. And he couldn't wait to get his hands on him if Wright got involved. Even if his, and I think he said something to the effect that, I don't care that he has the same last name as ours, Donnie, you know, but he ain't a Wright, and we all know that. You know, I can just hear him laying that thing out. He promised a good Tennessee dog whipping to the Stomper by Donnie just because Bearcat Wright had stole Donnie and his last name. He said, Donnie, y'all know you're going to whip him good because he done took our last name. I can't believe it. So, you know, I mean, Ron had everything, man. He had a reason for everything. Fans loved it as they always did. And because Ron was such a great interviewer, this match is going to help the card to draw the next Friday night. The show was shaping up even better than I had expected it would. Personality profile had to be the new babyface in Knoxville, Tommy Seeger. I'd asked Tommy to come in for TV even before his first live match the following Friday because I knew he had the talent to be a force in Knoxville, and I wanted him to get over as fast as possible. I had him dress in a suit because it was personality profile. It was exactly what Les and I had envisioned for these five-minute middle-of-the-show segments. Tommy had a great look and a super body that even his suit could not hide. He was soft-spoken and intelligent. Les asked him great questions about him, his family, his career to that point, and why he wanted to wrestle in Tennessee. His answers and his class, while giving those answers, made him an instant star. So much so that the fans in the studio erupted in applause for the new star immediately following the personality profile, even though it was pre-recorded and they had never seen him before. So, you know, they're watching in the studio on all those monitors in the studio there, and they got so into this personality profile that they're cheering for a guy who is making his very first appearance on the show simply because of how he's presenting himself. I was impressed with what was happening. It was perfect and presented the exact image everyone at the station was hoping that we would get when they accepted Southeastern Wrestling on their station. This show was really cooking by the time that Tommy Seeger finishes that personality profile. Are you familiar with him, Brian?
I am, and actually he was one of the people who was a part of All South Wrestling, which ran against the Georgia NWA promotion, Ann Gunkel versus the NWA. He was there. He was very close to Ann Gunkel, and he was a wrestler there. And there's actually a few of his matches from All South that still exist on YouTube.
Well, he's a tremendous worker, a great-looking guy, great body, fabulous worker. I was lucky to get him in the summer of 1975, and he lived across the mountains in Carolina. He would make the trip over every week. So great to have him on the show. Like I said, I mean, he did a tremendous personality profile, and it was exactly what we wanted. It was exactly what WBIR-TV wanted when they brought us on the air, is those type of segments that really didn't have to do with the wrestling, but just with the wrestlers themselves. It was a babyface tag champions time in the third segment, by golly. Jimmy Golan and Ricky Gibson got a tremendous ovation. And they did a little meet and greet introduction with the studio crowd before they even got in the ring. And it wasn't done much in those days. They actually started at one side. You've got a crowd around three sides of the ring. Cameras are on the fourth side of the ring. And they went around, shook hands. The crowd really got up. They were patting them on the back, really, really into these young guys. And the new champions wore their belts proudly, and their reception was far beyond what I had expected it to be. I had another idea for the two guys, though, and I talked to them about it before they went to the ring. And they played that perfectly as they entered the ring with the real quality opponents. They're working with two great guys. They're working with the Australian, Johnny Gray, and Dennis Condrey. The announcer, Phil Rainey, introduced the four as a regular tag match. And then both Jimmy and Ricky went to Phil, and they asked for the microphone. Jimmy started first. He thanked the fans for the rousing entrance they had just received, and he told them his partner, and he had decided to do something that had never been done in the sport. He gave the microphone to partner Ricky Gibson. Ricky announced that they were going to be defending champions, and that meant as often as possible. In fact, he said, they would defend their titles every time they were in the ring together, and that included TV matches. Well, now the crowd exploded again. You know, they were already over, and they were already getting a great reaction, and now they're saying to Phil, we're going to make this a TV champion, a tag team championship match. And as the crowd exploded, Phil took the microphone back and reannounced the match as a Tennessee Tag Championship match. You know, and sometimes, Brian, as a booker, you figure things that don't get over and disappoint you when they actually happen. Well, this was one of those times that I got blown away by how good this little statement was that we're going to defend every time we get into the ring. The studio crowd, all that get into the standing room studio, only about 250 people would fit into that studio. They sounded like 2,500 as this match progressed, and it lasted for about 20 minutes, a great television match. The action never slowed, and the fans never dropped the volume of their voices. When Ricky hit Johnny Gray with a dropkick off the top rope and Golden covered him for the pin, you could have heard that crowd from the old Big Jim Hess station 2 miles away. You know, I mean, they just roared, man. It was one of those moments as the owner of a new wrestling company that you believed you were starting to get somewhere. I really, really was loving this show. This was a great program. And when the young baby faces left the ring, they came straight to the set with Les to show their two straight falls victory the night before over the former champions, the Basses. Both falls were won by each of them drop kicking a Bass brother from the top rope and covering him for the win. Then they finished it by both of them at the same time. Now, this is, they're watching this match that we recorded the night before, and they both then, after drop kicking their opponents and winning the fall by covering them, then they both catch Sam Bass trying to make a save on the second one, and they both drop kick him at the same time into the front row of ringside. I mean, he didn't just go out of the ring. He actually landed on some ringsiders in the front row. So, you know, crowd just erupted. These boys are getting over, man. The studio audience watching numerous TV monitors in the studio showed the match, cheered continuously as if that match were live. You know, they were into it. This studio crowd is into it that day, and that makes such a difference in your television program. I told those guys to stay at the set for an interview after Les broke away for the two-minute TV commercial. They were really liking it. They were feeling it, man. And during that two-minute break, they left the set and went back out to hug the crowd and to shake hands with the studio audience while that two-minute commercial break was going on. It kept the audience in it. And when the cameras came back on them, the crowd was the loudest they had been all day. In the interview, they jumped on me and the assassin, their next opponents, the following Friday night, making fun of the assassin's weight and his big belly, and my calling myself the Tennessee Stud. It was undoubtedly the best segment yet on any of the four shows we had done on WBIR. I was very, very pleased with the third segment.
Well, there's a lot going on there. That seems like a real highlight. How do you wrap the show up? Because there's still more of the television show left.
Yes, we got one more segment, and I'm going to bring the big boys for sure in the last segment. I figured let's rock them a little bit. We're going to utilize those matches that we had recorded the night before. We're going to throw those same two baby faces into the ring for an actual live match against two great opponents. And then we're going to come back and finish the last segment with another tag match. And this one was not with the other team. What this one was with us. The assassin and I, the other team in that main event for the next Friday night. This time the crowd was just as responsive as they were for Golden and Gibson, but except there was with boos rather than cheers this time. We worked against the former Inferno, Rocky Smith, and Tommy Rich. Two damn good opponents here. I mean, two great tag matches. But this is a short one, and we demolished them in less than 5 minutes. I applied my Fuller leg lock to Tommy Rich, and at the same time, the assassin unveils a new finish for him by putting Rocky Smith out with a sleeper hold. The crowd roared their disapproval. I mean, it wasn't cheers. They just booed like crazy. And we went straight to the set to watch our win the night before against the Wright brothers in an all four men in the ring Texas Tornado match. The crowd again booed us as Les threw it to a TV station commercial break. When they returned to us, we stayed there for the interview. The assassin and I tore into those young baby faces. The assassin did his normal, very personal, soft in voice, but dangerous in content assessment of what was going to happen the following Friday. And I finished loud and strong with how risky it is for young guys like Golden and Gibson to be overconfident and making smart-ass remarks about somebody as bad as the assassin is and the history of the assassin. I focused on his new sleeper hold and predicted he would cut off the blood to one of their brains and I would knock the other one's brain out of his head. I guaranteed we were going to be new tag champions before the next television show. All in all, this was the best TV show on either TV station since I had come to Knoxville, and I couldn't wait until the next Friday night to see the crowd.
Well, what were the results? I mean, you give the results to the show, but what were the results in terms of box office?
Well, like I said, we've already talked about who won, but the attendance that night was well over 3,500 people. And all of that optimism that I had felt on the Saturday, watching that TV, sitting back there in the control room with the director and watching the TV, it translated into asses in the seats the following Friday night. I was really pleased to see what went on and what had happened from that television. I thought that was a fabulous TV for us, and it really put a bunch of butts in the seats that we were really in need of. And it was a good thing. It was a good feeling.
Ron, one of the other things you talked about at the top of the show, I want to make sure we get to it this week, is about the need to add more towns to Southeastern Wrestling.
Yes. Yes, and had a definite need for it. And after discussing the June 13th card and the new talent that was on it, some of those new people are already there, but there are more coming. I realized that I needed to have more than just Knoxville running each week to keep the kind of talent that I wanted. I wasn't going to be able to just have them come in and work one night and go home and be able to have them every week. So I've got to change things in my territory. And some of my present crew at that point is from Atlanta. Jody Hamilton is already there and going to be joined soon by another guy named Rock Hunter, another star that's going to live in Atlanta that's going to start coming. And already I've got coming out of the Carolinas, Tommy Siegler now and Les Thatcher. So they could not commit to work with me unless I could soon start to run at least 3 shows per week on like a Thursday night, a Friday night, and a Saturday. That way, they could stay over, get paid for 3 shows rather than just 1, and go home with more money in their pockets. And I thought that was very necessary at the time. If I didn't do that, I could see that I wouldn't be able to keep talent like Siegler and the Assassin, Rock Hunter, and there are going to be several others that's going to show up in the summertime that I wouldn't have been able to have them work for me full time with no more than 1 show per week to be able to pay them on. And, you know, let's just go on with that fact, you know, as promised, you know, like I did promise, we're going to talk about finding a couple of other towns in Knoxville area to run. And we're going to run them on a Thursday and a Saturday. Now, we had already run a few shows in the Tri-Cities, of Kingsport, Bristol, and Johnson City. And of those 3 cities, we'd only run in Kingsport and the beautiful Dobbin Bennett's High School. Beautiful, Jim. We hadn't had much luck there because our TV there had only been on the air for a few months. My arrangement with Jerry Jarrett and his mother, Christine, had not begun. We are talking, the 3 of us, about a regular Tuesday night schedule of running Johnson City in the Recreation Center, where we would split the profit after all expenses were deducted. I was waiting for my new WBIR TV show to get enough exposure in that market in the Tri-Cities to run there regularly. So in the meantime, I started scouting out other cities off to Knoxville, WBIR, King Mountain Station, I call it, and its huge signal. We had run one of them earlier in the year, Middlesbrough, Kentucky, a couple of times, but we had limited success there, obviously, because we were on a station that is signal, barely even got there. And you may remember we talked about this. It's the city where the Cumberland Gap was. It was discovered by Daniel Boone, and it was the key pass through the mountains to the western United States. It was a historic area, Middlesbrough, Kentucky. And at this point, the WBIR-TV had only been on the air for 4 weeks. That's not nearly long enough to build a big audience, but Middlesbrough was only 40 miles north of Knoxville. And the good thing was, it was being run in an inexpensive National Guard Army, and it also had picked up some signal from the old station, the Big Jim Hess station, because it was only 40 miles north of town. So I decided to go there and to try to get an even better deal on rent by running more regularly than just an occasional Thursday night. I set it up to start running it every Thursday night. And then now at that point, I needed a Saturday city. I picked one similar 40 miles east of Knoxville that had a better building than the National Guard Army in Middlesbrough and was just as good a rental rate. This city was called Morristown, and I set it up in a facility called the Tally Ward Building. The good thing about these 2 cities was the fact that the old Big Jim Hess station could reach some of the people in those areas, and that gave us some kind of recognition of our wrestlers prior to changing television stations. For cities further than 40 miles out of Knoxville, there's still no chance for me to be able to draw any crowds because beyond 40 miles outside of Knoxville and all directions around it, they have yet to ever see wrestling. So, you know, that's virgin country up there. And I'm waiting to get me 2 or 3 months of television under my belt to be able to open up towns that have never had live wrestling before. And when I do, it's going to be mind-boggling what happens.
Hey, Ron, one question for you. Beyond the limits of the power of the TV and the signal and where it goes, for the actual territory, for your business, what is your territorial limit? Like how many miles north or south, or maybe it's not miles, maybe it's just I can promote as far north as this town or as far south as this town without invading into someone else. Where are your limits?
Well, I can't go too far east, obviously. I get to the mountains there in the Smoky Mountains and you cross into Asheville. Now you're in Crockett's territory. You're in mid-Atlantic. You can't go too far. I'm not really confined by my signal going north because at this point, there's no one running Lexington, Kentucky. It's about 150 miles north of Knoxville. And it's beyond the signal of WBIR, but just barely. So I can go north into Kentucky. I can go into West Virginia. There is no one operating in West Virginia at this point. And West Virginia has its own television stations, Bluefield, West Virginia. There are a couple of other towns beyond Bluefield that had television stations as well. So nobody's there. So I can't really delve into much of Virginia because it's traditionally been a Crockett area, mid-Atlantic. So I can go Johnson City, Tri-Cities up there. I can go a little further north and a little further west into West Virginia. I can go north out of Knoxville up as far as the television signal goes and not be bumping into anyone. South, I can only go about halfway to Chattanooga because Chattanooga is one of Roy and Nick's towns. So I am confined by territories on all sides, but there's enough area there that I'm going to be able to create my own pretty decent, well, as most people call it, the best little territory that ever was. I'm going to create it just in that small little mountainous region there and do pretty darn well with it. So the historic change in Southeastern Wrestling was set to begin on Thursday, June 19th with Middlesboro, and would run on Thursday night the day after Knoxville, the day before Knoxville. And then the same weekend on Saturday night, we're going to run. This is the following weekend. Now, looking ahead, we're going to run on Thursday night in Middlesboro for the first time ever. We're going to run in Knoxville on Friday. And then for the first time ever, we're going to come back with the third day in a row in Morristown, Tennessee. And for the first time in Southeastern wrestling history, three towns would have Southeastern matches in three straight nights. Next week, we will discuss not just those matches, but for the first time, we'll talk about the payoffs to the boys and what kind of money was being made in 1975 for both the bottom boys and the top ones in Southeastern wrestling.
Well, Ron, as we wrap things up, we want to remind everyone on Facebook, the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. All you have to do is like that page, and automatically, you are friends with a wrestling legend. You can follow the Tennessee Stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last. You can follow the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network on Twitter at Super Podcasts. And you can hear me on the 605 Super Podcast at 605pod.com or available wherever it is that you find your favorite podcasts. Want to remind you once again, Super Studcast number 19, part 2, now available with Dirty Dutch Mantel. The entire 3 hours plus available at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast for only $2.99. You get in the door. Thank you to all the patrons. Thank you to all the new patrons who have been checking out the last several shows, and especially the people who have just jumped aboard for the latest Super Studcast number 19. We really appreciate the support of the Studcast. Ron, where are we going next week?
Well, we're going to go back to Memphis. We're going to make a trip to Chattanooga. Haven't been there in a while. We're going to make a trip to Louisville, where we haven't been in a while. We're going to be finishing up for Jarrett in the summer of 1975. We'll talk some about Southeastern's very first three-day weekend. We'll break down the Southeastern cards for that weekend, the payoffs, and the TV that supports that weekend. We're going to begin that archaeological dig in Manchester, Tennessee. We're just about ready to get that started, and we'll start looking ahead to June 27th and the huge card I was putting together for July 4th, 1975, first big holiday outside in Chilhowee Park. A lot of things happening, that's for darn sure.
Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud Ron Fuller, I am the Great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So full Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud. This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.